Thank you. Well, this is not an easy topic, but I'm glad that you all have come to wrestle with some of the things we're facing. As we enter another presidential election year, it's no secret that our country is deeply divided. The possibility that the other side will prevail strikes fear in, well, most of us. It's difficult to see how our differences can ever be resolved. The far right and the far left represent opposing responses to social change, and the very nature of those differences makes reconciliation unlikely. On the far right are those who resist change. These are conservatives or traditionalists because their goal is to conserve traditional social structures and relationships. Their desire to return to the past is summed up in the MAGA slogan, "Make America Great Again." They believe our best days are behind us. As the U.S. has seen growing diversity in race, ethnicities, religion, gender, and sexual expression, their response has been to keep out those they see as different by building a border wall, by installing floating barriers in the Rio Grande, by trying to ban Muslims from entering the U.S. These folks are concerned with circling the wagons, hunkering down to keep people like them inside and all others out. Religious and specifically Christian exclusivists recognize only one valid faith tradition, and for them that faith system is an absolute truth. On the left are those who embrace difference, who see changing demographics as enriching to our social fabric, weaving in colorful new threads of experience, culture, ideas. These folks want to open the gate, to find ways to welcome new people, to draw them in and incorporate their contributions to society. These progressives welcome social change as progress that improves our country. Religious progressives tend to be inclusivists, even pluralists. Now, I'm going to go out on a limb and assume that most UUs identify with this position. Inclusion underlies your guiding principles and your embrace of multiple sources of wisdom rather than a single absolute truth. But there's danger in this position as well. One of my UU friends lamented that by raising her kids to be tolerant of difference, she feared that they had become intolerant of intolerance. How do we get so far apart? What are the root causes of this chasm? And I have to give you a warning. This was my research area, so I've written a dissertation, a book, and many blog posts on this. So I'll try not to get into the weeds. This is why I preach from notes, so I don't go off on wild tangents, but I'm happy to talk later. Our current division represents differing responses to changes that resulted from social movements since the 1950s and 60s. There was the anti-war movement, civil rights, women's rights, gay rights. You can see specific backlash in Supreme Court decisions overturning Roe versus Wade and affirmative action, in local school boards banning books that deal with racial and gender or sexual differences, in states outlawing gender-affirming treatment for trans youth, and of course, in the storming of the U.S. Capitol on January 6th by white Christian nationalists who claim that their country is under threat. And you know what? They're right. White Christian dominance is under threat by changing demographics. Changes in immigration laws in the 1960s brought immigrants from countries that are majority Muslim, Hindu, other religions. Even more people have left organized religion altogether. These are the religious nuns, and that's N-O-N-E-S, not N-U-N. The result is since the 1960s, the percentage of Americans who identify as Christian has dropped from 90%, so almost total, population 90% to 64, less than two-thirds of the population. We see similar changes in our country's racial and ethnic makeup. The 2020 census reflects the first real noticeable decline in the percentage of white Americans, where it went from 64% in 2010 to 57% in 2020. Demographers believe that whites are on track to be a minority by 2042. The number of white Christians is declining in this country. And far-right extremists see this as a danger not just to their dominance, but to our country's safety and security. Those who fear difference see threats everywhere. Far-right rhetoric paints all Mexicans as rapists, criminals, and drug dealers. At the rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017, white Christians chanted, "Jews will not replace us," echoing an anti-Semitic trope known as replacement theory. A study of those arrested after January 6 revealed that counties with the most significant declines in the non-Hispanic white population were the most likely to produce insurrectionists. I'm going to repeat that. Most of the insurrectionists on January 6th came from counties where white non-Hispanic people are in decline. Their fears of changing demographics are warranted. White Christianity is on the decline, and with it the ability to impose their values on the rest of the country. I want to take a look at the United Methodist Church, my own denomination, for examples of how those fears are related to sexual and gender differences, but also the impossibility of finding common ground with those on the far right. The inclusion of LGBTQ plus persons has been a contentious issue in the United Methodist Church since its first general conference in 1972. If you don't know, the denomination was formed in 1968 of the merger of two different churches. And so at their first general conference, their first governing board in 1972, they imposed a restrictive language around sexual orientation. I wanted to understand how people who read the same Bible could have such different perspectives. And I read carefully the rhetoric of United Methodists who sought to and actually succeeded in excluding LGBTQ folks. What I found was that what lays beneath their rejection is not hate, it's not anger, it's fear. The fear that the world they know is changing. That the institutions that define them, marriage, family, church, are changing. And that scares people who like clearly defined hierarchical structures. Excuse me. That obviously includes cisgender white men who present as straight and who benefit from social patterns where they are dominant. But that also includes those who feel comfortable with clearly defined social relations and who fear that changing social structures will disrupt those relationships. And they will no longer be able to tell who is good and who is bad, who is right and who is wrong, who is us and who is them. After wrestling with the issue for almost 50 years, the United Methodist General Conference met in 2019 to consider two different plans that would allow local churches to decide for themselves how inclusive they would be. Now, this would be an exception to Methodist connectional polity, where pastors are sent by the bishop, they are not called by the church, and where all congregations abide by the same policies and much more detailed policy than in denominations like the UUs, where it's more congregationally based. Under these proposed plans, congregations could decide whether they would host same-sex marriages, and no one would force them to receive a gay pastor. But conservatives rejected both plans, saying they could not be in relationship with those who are violating scripture on this one particular issue. They insisted on unity in doctrine, consistency in practice, and accountability for those who violate United Methodist rules. And by the slim margin of 53% to 47%, they forced an even more restrictive policy on those who sought to include LGBTQ plus folks. Even though John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, is the one who coined the phrase, "We agree to disagree," conservatives rejected two plans that would have accommodated our differences on one issue. The exclusive nature of their beliefs that their truth is God's truth led them to reject any other belief as valid. They refused to allow any departure from their view within the same denomination. The insistence that they hold the only truth led them to circle the wagons around those who shared their beliefs and reject all others. Now, it's only natural that we migrate towards people who share our views. I feel some safety in preaching this message because I think I'm in a room with like-minded folks. In a recent New York Times column, Rabbi Sharon Bruce wrote, "Humans naturally incline toward the known. Our tribes can uplift us, order our lives, give them meaning and purpose, direction and pride. But the tribal instinct can also be perilous. The more closely we identify with our tribe, the more likely we are to dismiss or even feel hostility towards those outside it. She goes on, one of the great casualties of tribalism is curiosity. And when we are no longer curious, when we don't try to imagine or understand what another person is thinking or feeling or where her pain comes from, our hearts begin to narrow. We become less compassionate and more entrenched in our own worldview, end quote. One of the places that shapes tribal identity today is social media, which has served to further entrench our divisions. Under the guise of free speech, people use distortion and outright lies to fire up folks on their side of an issue. Propaganda spreads like wildfire on social media as algorithms feed us more of whatever we like, and the more outrageous, the better. This creates echo chambers that reinforce our beliefs and tie us even more firmly to those who share our perspective. So what do we do about it? In seeking to have productive conversation with someone you disagree with, it's always good to find some common ground. I remember when Jon Stewart was the host of The Daily Show, I understand he's coming back, at least part-time, he was interviewing someone from the far right, and I could not remember who, and I could not find it online, but just imagine someone you would think has a lot of differences from Jon Stewart. Stewart acknowledged their differences right away and said, let's find something we agree on. Do you like ice cream? And the guest said, yeah, I like ice cream. And he said, there we go. We both like ice cream. That laid a civil foundation for a conversation about their differences that, yes, was somewhat contentious, but at least it started from a foundation of agreement. Climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe takes a similar tactic with climate deniers, another subject on which we are miles apart. Hayhoe advises that we not pummel people with scientific data about or statistics about rising temperatures, but find out what someone cares about and then tell them how that's impacted by climate change. Do they love their grandchildren? Well, tell them what the kind of world that the next generations are going to inherit. Do they love good wine? Tell them how rising temperatures are impacting vineyards. Do they love the beach? Describe the danger that coastal areas face from rising sea levels. Make the conversation about something that matters to them. In other words, find out what makes them tick. A few years ago, Allegheny hosted the authors of the book, How to Talk About Hot Topics on Campus, From Polarization to Moral Conversation. They teach that moral conversation is not about winning an argument, but about mutual understanding. The three most important virtues, they say, in moral conversation are humility, respect, and generosity. Humility, respect, generosity. Humility is the willingness to be vulnerable and even wrong. They say, look for the truth in what you oppose and the error in what you espouse. In other words, don't assume that you are 100% right and the other party is 100% wrong. Respect means attributing the best of intentions to the other side. Instead of attacking, ask clarifying questions to better understand what they believe and why. And then finally, generosity, which involves respect, but also openness and gratitude for the other person's willingness to engage. Of course, there are some people who will refuse to even engage. They cower behind their bunker because they don't want to hear anything that could dismantle their carefully crafted worldview, believing that if one block is out of place, the entire structure will collapse. I often saw this with students who came from really conservative backgrounds, and so the trick was to find, is there an entry point? Is there some way you can get in and begin to challenge that? But often, I just couldn't do it because they relied so much on that structure, and like I said, one little thing out of place, and the whole thing collapses. Catherine Hayhoe says a small percentage of absolute climate deniers will never change, and so don't waste your time with them. But look for an opening, a glimmer of agreement, any hint that someone is open to conversation. In a recent column in the Christian Century magazine, Peter Marty writes about the importance of looking out of windows. And I love that you all have clear windows instead of stained glass in this sanctuary. He notes that the Jewish Talmud says that we should only pray in houses where there are windows. Prayer should be focused outwardly, Peter Marty also cites two advertising executives in Singapore who use the term sonder, S-O-N-D-E-R, to explain the importance of observing other people's lives. Sonder, he explained, is a 2012 neologism defined as the realization that each random passerby is living a life as vivid and complex as your own, populated with their own ambitions, friends, routines, worried, and inherited craziness. As we travel through this year and encounter strong forces that threaten to drive us even farther apart, may we practice sonder, regarding each person's life with curiosity. May we approach others with humility, respect, and generosity that can lead to a moral conversation. And may we open our gates and do whatever we can to decrease the distance between us, because the very future of our democracy depends on it. May it be so. Amen.